We're continuing, as we mentioned, our study of the book of Nahum. It's kind of a unique one of the minor prophets, as it's an oracle still to Judah, but against one of the nations, Nineveh, that previously, about 150 years before this, had repented when Jonah went and gave them the message of God's judgment. They repented and God was merciful to them. But within about 50 years of that repentance, so a generation, they had fallen back into their ways and were afflicting not only the people of Israel in the northern kingdom, but the people surrounding as well. So this is a pretty scathing book. It's a book of judgment against this evil nation, and it's divided into its three chapters, which are generally helpful. Those three are helpful divisions for us. The first one, as we'll see tonight, really working through the character of God, his justice and his ability, his power, are kind of the two premier ones, and how those function to comfort God's people. And then the chapters that follow are pretty filled with doom to Nineveh as the destruction of Nineveh is described. And there's this progressive movement in describing the actual attack on the city itself in chapter 2, moving into chapter 3. And then you broaden outside of the city of Nineveh itself to the empire that it represents. And God prophesies death to the entire nation of Assyria. So it is a bit of a dark book in that way, but it's actually also a book of great comfort. As here's a quote from a commentator: to the people of Nahum's day, this message was actually one of comfort and deliverance of oppressed people. For the oppressed to be freed, the oppressor must be removed. Nahum spoke about the end of the oppressor, Nineveh. So that's the book as a whole, chapter 1, again, emphasizing the character of God. So that's done by a poem in verses 2 through, it's debated, 2 through 6, 2 through 7, 2 through 8. It's not totally sure when it ends. We're going to say 2 through 7 for what we're doing tonight. There's this poem about God, about who he is and what he does, and it's a partial acrostic poem. So an acrostic poem is one that begins with each letter of the alphabet. So ours would be, 26 or so? I think it's 26 letters. So the first line starts with A, the second line starts with B, and in so doing, you have sort of the A to Z's of a topic, and you give an address of this topic kind of in its entirety is the idea. It's a whole poem because you've used the whole alphabet to describe it. So it's the beginning of Nahum has been the topic of quite a bit of conversation because it's a partial acrostic, and I'll just show that to you briefly. I know it's not for the sake of understanding the Hebrew here, but just the poem. There's a partial acrostic that's demonstrated here. So over here in the corner, we have the entire Hebrew alphabet. And the beginning of the first line in verse 2 is the Aleph. Now, you would think, So here's verse 1. This is verse 2. Here's verse 3, 4, five, so it's every other, 6. I started with the wrong verse, so we're one off, because this actually is verse 2. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then 8 begins right here. So normally what would take place is that as every verse is broken up perhaps into two sections, the beginning of the first section would be Aleph, the beginning of the second section would be Bet, and then you go from there. But in this case, you have Aleph, and then no next letter for 3 lines until the middle of verse 2. And there's our bet. As you might expect, the next line begins with Gimel. But then the character that you would expect in the next line is the Dalet. And there is no Dalet in the next line. Why not? I don't know. The following line begins, as you'd expect, with a Hey, and then the Vav following that. But then the next one is unusual. Our Zion's kind of out of place. It's not at the beginning. It's the second word rather than the first. Why is that? Don't know. Unsure. That wouldn't be normally how you'd write an acrostic poem. Then we have a Chet and Tet and Yod and Kof. So a couple things that are unusual is the second half of verse 3. There's no Dalet there. The beginning of this line, you'd expect it to be at the beginning, and then the fact that we only go through Kof. So only these characters are involved, minus the Dalet, only those characters are involved in the acrostic. So why a half acrostic? Why not a full one? Because normally when you write an acrostic, why would you write the A through H's of something? That doesn't make sense. That's not like the A through Z's. The whole point is to go through Z. So what do we do with something like this? There's kind of three options that we have. The most common critical option would be to amend the poem to be a complete acrostic. So we're going to fix it because it's broken. Or you might even go past verse 8 into verses 9, 10, 11, 12. Yeah, verse 9 has the Lamed and the Mem in reverse order, so it actually goes Mem Lamed. So you kind of have either more problems or you fix it. You know, you make all these adjustments and then you create this beautiful acrostic poem because it was lost in translation. That's option number one, critical option, which we're not going to take. The second one is that you just say, well, I don't know, it's kind of, maybe we just shouldn't treat this as an acrostic at all. You know, that it's not complete, so maybe we'll just take it as a poem, ignore the acrostic altogether. Or you say, as we're going to do tonight, look, a partial acrostic poem. Like, it's there, sort of, not totally, not exactly as you'd expect. Is he communicating something with a partial acrostic? Maybe. If acrostic poem is supposed to be this poem of completeness, are we supposed to have this sense of incompleteness? Well, maybe there's something to that. There's one commentator that suggests that the chaos of this acrostic poem describes the upheaval that results from the appearance of the divine warrior here. I like that idea. Is that exactly what Nahum's getting at? I can't say that with authority, but perhaps that's the idea here, that it's like, look at this normal poetic structure, and we're going to shake it, because that's what happens when the divine warrior shows up. And that's exactly what does happen in this poem in Nahum. So maybe that's the idea, but that's what we have in front of us, is a partial acrostic poem. Of course, unfortunately, it's very difficult to keep that in translation, and so you just communicate it, and then we know that it's there going on behind the scenes as we study tonight. So the prophet, Nahum, really answers kind of progressively three questions in this poem. And these are from a commentator named Meyer. The three poems. One, why will God destroy Nineveh? That's what's being presented as the destruction of Nineveh. Why is God going to do that? And that's answered in this first thing on the screen, verses 2 and 3. The second question is, can God destroy Nineveh? And after all, it's Assyria. This is the world power. There is no greater nation. There is no more fierce a people on the globe than Assyria. Is God able to do what he says he's going to do? And then finally, if God does this, then what's going to happen to the children of Israel, to God's children, when this consuming wrath flares high? Collateral damage, like what's going to happen to God's people? So those are the three questions. The first one, why will God destroy Nineveh? The answer is found in verses 2 and 3, and the answer is because of his divine justice. That's why God is going to destroy Nineveh. And these verses, 2 and 3, kind of unveil the tenor of the oracle as a whole, the book as a whole. The Almighty is angry. And that begins, we see that first in verse 2, with the statement of God's jealousy. So what does it mean that God is jealous? Quite naturally, we think of that as like envious, as a negative thing, jealous of another person, of their status, of their stuff, their money, their high place, whatever it might be. And that's we ought not be envious of other people. So how is it that God is a jealous God? The primary punch behind this word is communicating zeal or passion. And Nahum's intending to oppose the idea that God is passive. So God is a zealous, active God. So the question remains then, what is God zealous about? Why is he zealous? In what direction is he zealous? And the answer is, and is wrapped up in the idea of the word jealous, he's zealous about himself. That's who God is zealous about. Now, if that were us, that would not be a good thing. But if it's God, then it's the only thing he ought to be. God is completely and zealously committed to himself because he is not one among many. He is one above all. Therefore, he is zealous toward himself. And he's passionate that he receive worship exclusively because he's the only one worthy of worship. So that moves him to action. His zealous nature toward himself moves him to action. Positively, and that's not what's described immediately here, positively, God's zealous nature moves him toward redemption. Because even as we've seen in our study of the Pentateuch, God is seeking to prepare a people for a place. So in order to prepare a people for himself, then he needs to redeem them because they're broken. Right? So his jealousy moves him toward redemption. In a positive sense. It also moves him in a negative sense toward judgment. That the worship of idols, whether they're wooden ones or they're invisible ones in our hearts, that must be stopped. So he does that positively by redeeming some people out of that condemnation, and he does it negatively by judging the people that deserve to be condemned. So that's an expression of his jealousy as well. So contrary to us, God may not react immediately in his jealousy, but his jealousy inherently intimates that he is not being passive. He is always active in his jealousy, and that's one of the things that Nahum is seeking to teach us. That was also one of the things that Peter was seeking to teach us, right? That God is actually active, even in his patience, his long-suffering, he is being jealous. He's far more calculated than we are, but he will act. So out of his jealousy flows his vengeance. And he says it three times, same word, three times here. The Lord avenges and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries. So what is this avenging? This word describes someone that is responsible for the maintenance of justice in the society. Those are the people that will take vengeance. That individual then must have the proper authority behind their actions, or else they've gone outside of the law, right? They even in their vengeance are breaking the law once again. So you have to have the proper authority to be the one that is avenging. A commentator named Peels, he described avenging as the retribution of God, who, as the sovereign king, faithful to his covenant, stands up for the vindication of his glorious name in a judging and fighting mode, while watching over the maintenance of his justice and acting to save his people. So, this vengeance necessarily and immediately is following his jealousy, which is at least a part of the description, ironically enough, of his holiness, his complete commitment to himself, his set-apartness toward his glory exclusively, right? He is holy. And so his zeal and his judgment flow out of that holiness. Yeah, always his vengeance and his wrath, his fury, are going to remain divinely subordinate to his justice, right? His wrath is not going to overflow his justice as we might tend to do as human beings, right? We're going to take what we deserve and a bit more just to prove a point. God doesn't do that. His punishment of sin never extends beyond his system of justice. So he's jealous and he's avenging. He's also furious. He reserves wrath. And these words begin to flavor the entirety of the poem too. They just describe this kind of this inner fire of God. That's fueled by the disobedience of the people, the disobedience of Judah and Israel many times throughout the prophets, and here particularly the disobedience of Nineveh. So it's this inner fire of God's indignation that's fueled by the disobedience of other people. It's dangerous to cross an angry God. But that's not all that he is. He sort of flips to the maybe not the other side of God's nature, but perhaps from our perspective, that's an easy way to describe it. His slowness to anger, his patience. Nahum doesn't really expand upon this idea at all. He just states it. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power. So his slowness to anger, this doesn't mean that God is slow and that he's maybe incapable, like I'm not quite ready yet. He's not incapable. He's also not nervous about what Nineveh is going to do. Therefore, he's waiting. He's not weak. He's not either reactionary, right? These all point to a calculated response, that he is slow to anger. Now, that's connected in Nahum to his power. He's slow and great in power. So someone that responds that way, I can't think of a specific movie off the top of my head, but you see this in a movie, that the powerful one who is offended, when he is very slow and calculated in his movements, it's because he is completely unaffected by the one coming against him. You can throw all you want at me. I don't have to defend myself. Right, I'm coming slowly, I'm coming powerfully, and there is nothing that you can do. That's the image that's presented here. He's slow in anger and great in power. So he is completely unthreatened by Assyria. His power enables his patience toward tyranny or towards the tyrant. Now, this is actually a break in the normal flow of this. This is verse 3 is kind of one of Israel's creedal statements. Right? The Lord is slow to anger and abounding in chesed, abounding in his loving kindness. That's the normal statement. So here, instead of emphasizing, because this is an oracle against Nineveh, instead of emphasizing the covenant love of God in his slowness, he emphasizes the might of his power. He reassures them of his ability to bring about judgment. So it's kind of an interesting break in the normal statement. Not pointing towards forgiveness, but toward reliability, towards supreme power. He's introducing the answer to the second question, can God actually do what he's saying he's going to do? Can he destroy Nineveh? It's a rather chilling statement in the second half, in the next line, and will not at all acquit the wicked. His justice then does not permit him to just let it go, to let sin go. He's going to maintain his record, and he's not going to let anyone off, particularly not the wicked, not Assyria here. And he begins then God's interaction with creation. So God as the supreme, God as the transcendent one, who is the one who's made all of this stuff. He has the ability to use it, to form it, to move it, to push it, to pull it, to command it, to do whatever it is that he wants to do. So the Lord has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm. The clouds are the dust of his feet. So that which is above us, the clouds, is below him. He stands upon that which we look up to. demonstrating his transcendence, right, his aboveness. And he will do, as it says, the Lord has his way. Whether it's in the tornado or the hurricane, the tsunami, he directs it. It's all underneath him. It's almost like a little child just creating a, you know, spiral in the bathtub. He's like, I can do what I want with this. It's my stuff. So that brings us to the natural question that would follow. Okay, that's a big statement, right? That God's going to, that he's angry and that he's furious. Because if you have, you know, perhaps a child coming at you angry, that's one thing. But if you have the most supreme being in the universe coming at you angry, that's another. So is he able? How able is this angry one to do what they're setting out to do? Child, we might not have to be worried. Divine one, well, maybe we should be worried. And that's what he begins to answer in this second portion. Can God destroy Nineveh? Yes, he can. He is the omnipotent one. So he moves kind of from his characteristics to his activity, what he's doing. He rebukes the sea and makes it dry. And he starts into this little creative poem about God undoing all of the things that he has done. Who is it that made the sea? Who is it that filled it up with water? God did. And he can undo it. He can make it dry. Rivers normally flow with water, right? That's what they're intended to do. They're carved out in the earth. And what can God do? Well, he can empty them. He can make them full of air rather than full of water. Bashan, Carmel, Lebanon, these are three very fertile areas. And he's saying, I can take this fertility that I have planted into the earth, and I can dry it up in a moment. I can make it nothing. And that's going to have very significant impact on all of these people who are resting in the fertility of these places. Right? They need food, and they need water, and they need lumber. They need all of this stuff in order to survive, and I can take it away in a moment because I put it there, and so I can remove it. So it's just the statement of, once again, kind of supremacy and ability to do what he wants, rebuke the sea. This first one could even be a kind of a reference to the Red Sea moment where he can dry it up, you know, he can split it, he can do whatever he wants to do. Everything responds to his bidding. There isn't a rock, a tree, or a raindrop that sits, stands, or falls against his command. It all obeys him. Verse 5 has kind of very Psalm 18 or Psalm 46 imagery of the presence of God. When he shows up, what does creation do? It quivers, right? The mountains quake, hills melt, earth heaves. So the very things, once again, the foundations of the world that remain steady, those things that we could anchor something to and trust that it would never move, those things shake up in his presence. The immovable moves in the presence of the divine. Yes, the world and all who dwell in it. So this little reminder here at the end of verse 5 that people are also a part of his creation. Therefore, the people will also do his bidding. Whenever he commands them, they must obey. Verse 6, from a literary standpoint, is kind of, it's like an anger salad or like a little wrath salad. He uses four different words for it: indignation, fierceness, anger, and fire or fury. He's a couple different words here to describe just the heat that's coming off of God in this moment. And the song is crescendoing, it's building, and the volcanic fury here of the Almighty is released. It just came out of the mountain and it's spewing, and nothing is going to be able to stand before him. He has full ability to take down Assyria, is the idea here. Their chariots are like matchbox cars. Their arrows are like safety pins. Their great numbers are like a colony of ants, right? They're not intimidating at all. He can do what he pleases. They are nothing. They will not. These two rhetorical questions: who can stand before his indignation? No one. Who can endure the fierceness of his anger? No one, because it's like a divine volcano that has just gone off. Which leads us to the third question, because that's terrifying. Nobody wants to stand in the way. Assyria is very close to Judah. Right? You don't want to be in the crossfire here. And so, what will happen to God's children when the consuming wrath flares high? Verses 7 and 8. God has promised that he will prove himself to be a stronghold for his people. God is a stronghold for his people. And it revolves around, back to his character, his goodness. The Lord is good. I don't know. Did you just read the part that came before this? Yes, the Lord is good. And you might almost hear them saying, like, that's still true, right? That's still true, right? Because it's scary. It looks very angry. And that's something that's, I think, highly misunderstood. The Lord's justice and judgment are a part of his goodness. The oppressors never would be freed without the violent justice of God. It is good that evil be brought low. That's the only way that it would ever be abolished, is for a powerful and violent good individual to come against them and to free the oppressors. And that's what we'll see happens. If you just glance down at verse 13, he's going to break off his yoke, the yoke of Nineveh. He's going to burst their bonds apart. He's going to free them. That's what he's here to do. So he is still good, right? Yes, his judgment is a part of his goodness. And he knows the difference between those who are for him and those who are against him. So here's, once again, a very Peter thing to say, right? The Lord knows how to deliver the righteous, and the Lord knows how to condemn the wicked. He knows what he's doing. He's very precise in his calculations. So for the good, for those who trust in him, for those who fear him, he will be a stronghold. Oh, isn't that what we wanted when all the earth was shaking? Everything stopped or started moving. Maybe the place where you built your fortress shook, but he is the fortress for those people. He is the stronghold. He is the place of salvation and deliverance. So yes, they will be okay. They will be delivered. But not Nineveh. Let's just reiterate that. And he's going to now begin this sort of back and forth. Well, for Judah, it looks like this. For Nineveh, it looks like this. For Judah, it looks like this. For Nineveh, it looks like this. Because with an overwhelming flood, he will make an utter end of its place, Nineveh, of Nineveh's place, and darkness will pursue his enemies. So he's like, in my goodness, in my stronghold in the day of trouble, I'm not a stronghold to Nineveh. No, they're still overwhelming flood. They're still, even I'm going to send darkness to chase them down the path of death. Like, it's not going to be good for them. And so what he does then is kind of introduce the remainder of the chapter, these two themes of comfort for Judah while simultaneously condemning Nineveh. And I think that rises to the surface as the truth that we sort of walk away with. And we've said it already today, but just that idea that one is not had without the other. They are held together in the divine hand. He accomplishes one by accomplishing the other one. And were he not to condemn, there would be no comfort. So here is this kind of back and forth bit. So 9 through 11 is that the Lord cares for Judah by ending Nineveh. So the kind of the poetic language is done, and now we have the prophetic, more normal prophetic language beginning. So what do you to Nineveh? What do you conspire against the Lord? He will make an utter end of it. Affliction will not rise up a second time. For while tangled like thorns and while drunken like drunkards, they shall be devoured like stubble, fully dried. From you comes forth one who plots evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. So you can see kind of the beginning and the end, the framework of this poem. You have the conspiracy against the powerful one. And then in the middle, there's this three pictures that actually are, they describe the hopelessness of the conspirator. So this is not something that Nineveh stumbled into by accident, right? They sat in their war room and they decided that they were going to wage war against Yahweh. That's what they decided to do. And God has announced in this oracle that he is going to bring an utter end of it. It is going to be done. He's going to squelch the rebellion, so much so that affliction, or Nineveh's, what Nineveh's seeking to accomplish, that is the end of their conspiracy, is affliction, will not rise up a second time. So it's going to, this condemnation, this utter end, is going to be so severe that Nineveh will be obscure. They can't stand up again. There won't be, as he'll say in a moment here, there's no generation here to Nineveh. So a threefold statement of this hopelessness. You are like the tangling of thorns. You are like the drunkenness of drunkards. You are like the devouring of stubble fully fried, fully dried. I mean, it is fried, basically. A little bit of both. So the bush is helpless to the thorns. The bush is helplessly taken over by the thorns. The drunkard is helplessly taken over by drink. And the field is helplessly taken over by fire. There's no standing against it. It's the idea here. So the stubble fully dried is like what would be left after harvest, after you cut it all off and it sits there for a moment. If you've ever walked in a field after harvest, it's just like the crunchy, dry stuff that's left. He's like, it's that ready to be caught up in flames. So Nineveh is hopeless against God. Why? Because it's the Lord that's going to make an utter end of them. It's the person that's coming against them. Why is he going to do that? Once again, because from them, from Nineveh, comes forth one who, or it's actually from Assyria, maybe even from the world, comes forth one who plots evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. So that's either, in a smaller sense, referring to one of the kings, maybe the current king of Nineveh or of the empire of Assyria. Or you zoom out a little bit, and it's the city. The city is the bad counselor who is counseling the empire. You might even say, if you zoom out more, that the empire of Assyria is the wicked counselor as they counsel the world. So however you take it, I don't know how specific it's intended to be, but there is this enemy, this opponent, this foolish one. When you have counsel, you're supposed to have something that is wise, but instead you have wickedness. And that's why they're going to be hopelessly destroyed. So the Lord cares for Nineveh, or the Lord cares for Judah by ending Nineveh. And we have 12 through 13, which is a word of comfort, thus says the Lord, toward Judah. So he speaks to them, though they, which is Nineveh, though Nineveh is safe, and likewise many. So here's two things that Nineveh has going for it. Secured, and it is large, it is abundant. Though they're safe, and likewise many, yet here's how, in this manner, they will be cut down. When he passes through. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. For now I will break off his yoke from you and burst your bonds apart. So God speaks to Judah again concerning Nineveh, a word of comfort, a word of promise. It's a messenger oracle, thus says the Lord. So what God is encouraging them to do here is to not look with human eyes upon Nineveh. Because when you do, they look safe, they look abundant, they look very strong. The things that they're resting in look quite secure. But he says, don't look at them, don't look at their human strength, because yes, they are currently secured. Yes, they are currently powerful. But when I pass through, they're going to be cut down. Because once again, this is what I'm stating I will do, and as I've demonstrated, I do have the ability, the power to do it. Now, nothing's going to stand in his path, but God says to Judah, right, I understand that they have afflicted you. And in fact, I have afflicted you through them, by them. They were my instruments. There's a bit of a twist, right? God is using Nineveh. He's using Assyria for his purposes to accomplish his jealous means. God will use even wickedness to accomplish his purpose. So though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more, for I will break off his yoke from you and burst your bonds apart. So there will be freedom, there will be deliverance when I pass through, because I'll stop using them against you. I will have accomplished what I wanted to with them. I will dispose them for their opposition and for their unbelief and for their wickedness, for their wicked counsels. They rose up against me, even rose up against you. How dare they? Right? I used them against you, but they are still held responsible for what they've done, for the intentional counsel and conspiracy that they have made. And now God brings them completely low. And in so doing, once again, we have that theme of freedom through judgment. The bursting of Judah's bonds. No more having a yoke. No more being used as a plow animal. Now he's free. Verses 14 and 15, the final two, they're both unique statements. 14 is a condemnation specifically toward Nineveh. So he addresses the city now. Lord has given a command concerning you. There's Nineveh. Your name shall be perpetuated no longer. Out of the house of your gods, I will cut off the carved image and the molded image. I will dig your grave, for you are vile. There's kind of three parts to this. The first part is that their generations cease. So this goes back to speak to the finality, that there won't be a second, they won't arise a second time, and they're not going to recover from this. It's a complete destruction. So there's not going to be the next generation of little Assyrians coming up. No, your name is done. It's over. Then he moves to address part of why he's so mad, why he's so angry. He's also going to destroy, in destroying them, he's going to destroy their idolatry. He's going to destroy their houses of worship. Because out of the house of your gods, I will cut off the carved image and the molded image. That's who they're worshiping. It's idolatry. It goes back once again to verse 1. God is jealous, and the Lord avenges. He demands worship because he's the only one, he's the exclusive one that deserves it. So send it to him or send it to no one. If you won't send it to him, then you're categorized in unbelief. If you seek to blend worship of him with worship of another, then that's categorized as unbelief. It's wrong. You dare not make any molten image, right? You dare not worship any other idol. So he's going to do this surgery. He's going to cut them out. He's like carving out the heart. And he's going to cast it away because that's where their false worship, or their false worship, reveals their brokenness, their wickedness. So he moves from the generations to the worship, and then finally to their burial. So he says, I will dig your grave, for you are vile. Now that word vile is it's kind of a unique word. It communicates like lightness in contrast to something that's weighty. So they're like light. And I think what the poetry here is saying, so because you are sort of insignificant, then your burial is going to be insignificant. Normally, you would want for your family or your maybe even your comrades, whatever, to come around you. If you're a soldier, then your battle buddies would want, you know, they're going to take your body off the field. They're going to send you home, give you a proper burial, that sort of thing. But there's no one left. the only one to bury them is God. God will dig their grave. And their grave just so happens to be the ruined city of Nineveh. Right? That's their grave. You will rest upon this pile of rubble where you defied me, where you took counsel against me and you plotted and you conspired. So I will dig your grave because you are insignificant. You are vile. He ends then, this is Nahum speaking, and he calls the people to look. He says, behold, see, and he's announcing the victory from the battle. He says, behold, look, Judah, on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. So after a battle, right, you're going to send a messenger, send a runner back home because the city wants to know what the end of the battle was. So he's saying, look, I see it's almost like the dust, the trail from this mountain runner as he comes to proclaim something to us. And he's bringing, thankfully to Judah, good news, right? That means victory. That means we won, which has the resulting peace, right? No more war. We actually, the oppressor has been brought down. We are now, the land can breathe again, and we can with a sigh of relief because there's peace. Okay, so in the Nineveh context, this is a very wonderful news. Again, this is the demonstration of their bonds being broken apart. This is what actually happens when God arrives. There's this deliverance. So the result is joyous worship, right? Keep your appointed feast, perform your vows, for the wicked one shall no more pass through you, as God said he would no longer pass through them. He can't rise up. His name will be perpetuated no longer. He is utterly cut off. So God kept his promise. He is the mighty divine warrior. He walked among the enemies of God, and he cut them down completely, and now there is good news, namely peace. So peace is producing worship. Peace produces, God's peace produces a rest and joy in his people's house, or in his house. So if verse 15, which is, I think, kind of the heartbeat of Nahum, if verse 15 doesn't take you immediately outside the book of Nahum, then I don't know what would. As we think about deliverance from evil, as we think about the ultimate tyrant, as we think about the one who's made promises, particularly concerning this tyrant, think about the present state of God's people. Zooming outside of Nahum and more to a principled approach here, in exile, right, under the heavy hand of the tyrant presently. This promise to Judah, this burden against Nineveh as a word of comfort to Judah, is far more, or it demonstrates far more than just one historical event. Right? God is not just jealous and vengeful and a good stronghold as it relates particularly to Judah against Nineveh. That is God's character. That is who he is toward his people. This is a demonstration of the whole. This is one example of who he is and what he does. And so as we think from a gospel context, these are very gospel words. So the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the good tidings and the peace, that's euangelion. I mean, that's the good news that's being, as we come to the New Testament. This is the same ideas, the same sort of principles. And when he talks about peace, this Hebrew shalom is far more, even to the Hebrews, it's far more than just, oh good, we're not in a war anymore. It's not that kind of peace. Like, how long is America at peace? Well, that's the last time we were fighting. Not like that. This is the complete, like, full lifestyle of abundance, of wholeness, of completeness. It describes this total societal well-being. All is well. It's something, it's a stone uncut, right? It has not been touched, hasn't been tampered with. It is full. And it is, in another way, another aspect of this that Solomon gets at in his dedication of the temple, it is completely or singularly devoted as well. The heart of someone should be characterized by shalom, by wholeness, complete devotion to one thing, wholeness, not just not being shattered into to devotion to many things, right? So this complete devotion to Yahweh, that's the fruit of his good news, the good news that he abolished the enemy. He took down the tyrant, and he made a way forward for us. There will no longer, there's no second generation, at this point, there's no second generation of evil. There's a totalness to the destruction that's described here. And so it raises the question then in reverse. Well, as we look at the evil around us today, can God do that? Is God able to take down the supreme tyrant? According to Nahum, yes. And will we survive that war? Will we survive that divine volcanic eruption? Yes, we will. Because the Lord is good. And he is a stronghold in the day of trouble. And he knows those who trust in him. He's able to completely and precisely categorize and judge appropriately. So that's what chapter 1 of Nahum is about. If you have any questions, we do have a few minutes. And if not, then we'll just close in prayer. So any thoughts or questions about the first chapter? Yeah, so verse 12, though they're safe and likewise many, yet they'll be cut down. That kind of idea of if God has promised something, then we ought believe it. I think that's a quite natural human principle, and it comes up throughout the Old Testament too, even in Samuel choosing David. You have this, God looks upon the inside while man is looking at the outside. Because you look and it's like, wait, all these big strong brothers, why not one of them? Why the little guy? Why the runt? Well, because God looks upon the heart. We look on the outside, and we're very prone to do that. So it's a good reminder that we keep our gaze upward and not outward, right? Worrying about all the strength of humanity around us and the depth and depravity of the evil. No, let's keep our eyes on how powerful God is and what he's promised to do. Let's rest in that. He's fully able.
I took your message 2 weeks ago to heart, and so I've been studying him.
That's good.
But anyway, he doesn't really mention Nineveh in chapter 1.
No, he doesn't at all.
It seems to me that that would suggest that it's kind of a general what God is going to do with evil. And especially the evil that has plagued mankind, that is warfare. The Assyrians were a warring people. That's what they lived for, what I've read.
Mm-hmm.
They were conquering people.
Yes.
They couldn't be satisfied with what they had. It was just a matter of lust for war. This is an answer to that question about why does God allow war? Why are there wars in this world? Should we be trying to make peace? And I think that the answer to it is that the Lord is slow in anger.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I was also thinking about Habakkuk and his problem with Babylon. It's the same kind of thing, because the children of Israel would be looking and they would say, well, God, in Isaiah, it says that Assyria was my hand of discipline. And they'd be looking and say, how can you have a murderous, ungodly, warlike people be your hand? Are you going to let it go?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So there are a couple things there. So the first one was the delay of using Nineveh's name. And I think that is significant. It's not until chapter 2, verse 8, that he first brings up the name Nineveh. So then we take the oracle at the beginning, right? It says that this is a burden against Nineveh. So we know it from the line 1, before the statements have started. And then it's not till later that he says their name explicitly. I think that is helpful, because as Judah listens, they know intuitively he's talking about Nineveh, but he's not saying their name. And that is important. It does make it more general. It does make it principled. The idea of war, that sort of sent me off in a couple different directions. One, war ultimately is revealing of idolatry, revealing of the desire to worship and fulfill passions that are elevated above the desire to worship and obey Yahweh. Then ultimately God's greatest war is a war not just against war or against killing or against violence, but against idolatry. It's against false worship. Which means that when he brings the war to end all wars, that what's left is pure worship. What's left is his people that he's prepared for himself, for his jealousy is fulfilled. Right, that there would be one song raised only to him is satisfied. I'm trying to remember the third thought. Babylon, God using evil means to accomplish his means. I think that does go back to verse 2. When it says God is jealous and the Lord avenges, that avenging, once again, is the only way that you can properly be an avenger is if you have the authority to be that avenger. Otherwise, you're this revenge idea, just this like, well, they did, so I'm going to do, is improper. It's wrong. You have to wield the authority in order to do that. But when you do wield the authority, then the means is up to the one wielding the authority, right? And if that's God given to humans, then he's often described the means. But if that's God as God, then he can discern whatever means he wants, right? He could use a righteous means. He could use an unrighteous means. He can do the right thing however he deems best.
Thing that,
yeah,
it's a little detail, mm-hmm, and maybe it's not, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that verse where he says, he knows, verse 7, he knows those who trust in him.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that Jesus quoted, mm-hmm, something similar to that in the Sermon on the Mount.
Yep.
And as I've read the Sermon on the Mount before, I've had the question, well, how in the world can I know if he knows me? That seems to be the crux of the matter regarding salvation. Does he know me? How do I,
yeah,
know that?
Yep.
Well, this verse helps me, because it says he knows those that trust in him.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't have to be uncertain about whether he knows you.
Yeah. Yeah, so John 10:27, has all of these elements together. So my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. Are you going to have that description of, well, how do I know if I'm known? Well, there they are following, right? There they are, right in his fold. So that's kind of that same thing, that trust is an evidence, a description, not description, an evidence of being known. So I think, to the questioning individual, saint or otherwise, a good question would be, well, what are you resting in? do you trust? Not what have you done? When did you believe? What did you pray? Those sorts of things, but do we believe that he is good?
It's what God does to his people too, because he, you know, the Bible talks about God replacing our stony, antagonistic heart with one that is inclined toward him. So when a person is converted, it's more than just a changing of the mind and making a right turn instead of a left turn. It's, mm-hmm. it's a total change in lifestyle, which others can notice, mm-hmm. and you certainly can, because you can look back to, well, I used to do this, but I don't want to anymore. And that's part of the big change too, is that with this new heart, we have a new outlook.
Regeneration produces change. It is change, but it also has visible demonstrations very often. Yeah. Okay. Good thoughts. Let's close in prayer.